Welcome back to another episode of the Head Game Podcast. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarello.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
Today is episode 59 when we are with Jeff Manto, our very special guest, a former Major League Baseball player and coach and now consultant. Today we're going to be talking about the mentality of hitting, the psychology behind performing as a professional athlete, and a whole lot more. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. So is it something about the simplicity of country music?
Yeah, it's the salt of the earth.
Yeah.
It's real. It's jeans and trucks.
Right. Beer, women.
It's not khakis jeans and collar.
Beers and trucks and scratches on trucks. All right. Cool. You ready?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, we are?
Yep.
Okay. So talk to me about your most significant achievement as a Major League Baseball player.
I think in a selfish non-team way, I think the biggest thing I did was the four home runs in a row. That was kind of a magical moment that I did not know I was going through until I flew out to right field. And then I looked up at the scoreboard and I saw that, and they announced the two records that I had tied. So significantly, selfishly, that's what it was. But I think a whole lot more goes into that question, to where the most significant, just getting there, man. Just right. Getting there. Mm. I mean, the feat of getting there, the what it took to get there, the ups and downs, the tears, the bringing the game brings you to your knees. And so just getting there was a pretty grand moment. But then comes the World Series games, and there comes the playoff games, and all the camaraderie. So there's a lot of significant things, but man, there's nothing better than just that that feeling, that high of just getting the call in the office going, hey, man, you're going to the big leagues. It's like, wow.
So tell me a little bit more about that, Jeff, as far as, you know, the I almost make the analogy of professional athletes being in the military. Like, everyone else is just a civilian. Yeah. We're professional athletes, we only see on TV. We very rarely see them in person, if we're fortunate enough to meet one. What was that like for you? Tell me about your journey to get there. That really, you know, most people only start paying attention when people are doing well, right? Or when they've arrived.
Right, when they're there, when they make the big show.
Exactly. Or when you stink.
Yeah, exactly.
That's when they really pay attention.
You know, the journey was, when I look back on it, it still was, sometimes I still get nervous for myself. When I put myself back into, like, you see some of those stories now, like a note to myself 10 years ago, and the guys write about themselves, what would I do different 10 years ago? I still remember being horrified. I remember being scared. I remember being nervous. I remember the uncertainty was just about 40 pounds on your shoulders, because I had no idea. I had no escape. I didn't know how to deal with it until I met Ken. And when we talk about Ken Revizzo all the time,
yeah.
And this wasn't until like 4 years later. So the weight of the world on you, I mean, you're trying to perform. You don't know. The hardest part was not knowing how the game itself was played. I didn't know what happens behind the scenes. I didn't know what they were evaluating. I had no idea what development meant. I had no idea where I was on a food chain. And it was just nervous every day. I was nervous every single day. I remember being in Davenport, Iowa, being in right field, and kind of reminiscent of Bristol, to where you had the clock. And I remember distinctly watching that clock, because I was so homesick. It was the damnedest thing. And I'm like, this is what I wanted. I got to Davenport, Iowa, and I'm watching this clock. I'm watching this clock. And it was awful.
Did you connect that feeling in that very moment as what we call homesick? Like, was it reminiscent of a world that was more familiar to you? Did you want to leave? Like, what was your mind?
My mind was like, hey, but you get to the finish line. Get to the finish line. I felt myself looking at the last game of the season. Like, I got to get to the finish line. I got to get out of here. I know, but I can't leave, because if I leave, that's it. You know, it was one of those type things. And
I don't want to leave too soon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. Whatever that feeling is and whatever it's called, I have no idea. But I remember that mostly. And just like that picture that's out there of the iceberg. what you're talking about, people just see the tip of the iceberg. They don't see what happens.
Right.
And yeah, they only see the 10% up top, 90% is kind of under the surface.
Right. And like nobody saw the 3 mile walk to the ballpark. Nobody saw the 0 for 10s, the 0 for 15s, the 1 for 20s. Nobody saw the 36 errors in Quad City. Nobody saw that, but I had to live it. I had to feel it. I had to deal with it. And
when you talk about all of those things, Jeff, the first word that comes to mind for me as a performer, as an athlete, is resilient. The 36 errors. How does a professional athlete in situations like that push through and just keep grinding? Was there a method?
No, there really wasn't. It was one of these things where you grew up fast. You know, you grew up really fast. And I think sometimes like your upbringing sometimes has to take over too, because you know you got to have something. They say we're resilient. You got to fight.
You got to have something in the tank.
Right.
You got to fight, man. And I think I learned that. And I thought, oh, all that stuff I heard on the streets, all the stuff I heard in the house. Hey, one of these days you're gonna have to do this by yourself. And that moment, it was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Now's the time. Now's the moment, because I never failed. Never failed. Mm-hmm. You know. And
when did you enter in? When did you get into like the minor leagues? How old were you? Were you? Did
1985.
You play? Okay. Did you play in college at all?
I played at Temple University. I left high school. I got drafted by the Yankees as a pitcher, and then I went to Temple my freshman year as a pitcher, and I couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And I was a thrower.
You had control issues.
I was nuclear loose. Yeah. And so all of a sudden I had the gall, I guess, to tell one of the most decorated Division I baseball coaches in the country, I don't want to pitch anymore. I want to play shortstop. And he goes, you want to do what? And I'm like, I can't believe I just said that.
Did you recognize that because you were having difficulty pitching, that if you didn't make that move, that maybe your career was in jeopardy?
Yeah. And it was one of the things I think I learned about myself, you know, in hindsight, was when my back was against the wall, it made me more aware. Like, you better, hey man, you got to fix this.
You started paying attention to that feeling.
Right, exactly. And then all of a sudden, it worked out. You know, Skip Wilson like worked me out a little bit of shortstop, and I hit some batting practice. And next thing you know, things worked, and I never saw the mound again.
And you did play short in high school as well as pitch, correct?
I can imagine you now getting drafted by the Yankees in high school, right? Coming out of high school as a pitcher, and then having to say, "Well, that's not my career."
Yeah,
what's that shift like for you?
It was awful. It was awful. And it's like, when I left high school, and I played three sports, and so you were playing year round.
Right.
You were playing
year round. You were a football, basketball, baseball guy.
Right. And so you never stopped. And to get to college and be what they call a pitcher only, it was like, this is what we do. We just sit around and watch. I wasn't used to that. Right. And then I took an evaluation, evaluation is that I can do this. I can do this. I can do what I see on the field. I can be that guy. And I had enough guts to go ask. And
so when you made that shift to shortstop, what did that then dictate as far as your career is concerned?
Well, it turned it around. It made me more relaxed. I was successful at it. All of a sudden, I became a guy, so to speak, and it lifted my confidence, to say the least. It lifted my confidence. And you know, from that point on, from just having enough guts to say, what are you going to do, say no? You know, things turned around and they flourished.
When you say guy, do you mean like part of the team, like one of the guys? Or
yeah, like, so I was a guy. Like, all of a sudden, like, okay, we got a guy in the lineup.
It's no longer the pitcher coming out there.
Yeah,
it's
just nothing worse than being labeled as a pitcher.
Yeah, pure hitter. Yeah.
When you think about what's going on in today's 2021 baseball, you've had over a 30-plus year career playing in the major leagues, in the minors, internationally, hitting coach, the whole gamut of your experiences. When you look at young players today, what would be your advice?
I would tell them to be versatile. Make sure you're able to be versatile, because that's what happened to me. I went in as a pitcher. I went to college as a pitcher. I left as an outfielder, got drafted as an outfielder, and my major league debut was a first baseman. You know, so I would tell these kids that you got to be ready for anything, and you got to be ready to fight. It's simple. You got to be ready to fight, and when the opportunity comes, you got to be ready. And you got to be a little bit, you got to be fearless. You got to be half nuts, and just go play. Just keep your mouth shut and just go play. I think a lot of people get concerned. I want to play shortstop. I want to play third. I want to catch. I want to pitch. Just hit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care where you play. You just want to hit, and you got to pay attention to the hitting side. And if you're going to play like a defensive player, you got to be a well above average defensive player to even get recognized. So you got to bang. The most important thing is you got to bang.
Yeah, I find a lot of people are now doing the specialization, right? I'm this, and I'm going to practice this, and I'm going to train this, and I'm going to find people to do this. But you're talking about the versatility and the nature of it. Do you think your other sports helped with that, your ability to kind of adapt to those different things?
I think they did. I think not so much. A lot of people talk about the movements on a court. They talk about the movements on a football field. And they talk about the movements. Now, baseball is probably the least athletic out of all of them. So I don't know if it helped or hurt. But what I think the three sports did is taught me how to compete against different mentalities. Like I read all the time.
That's
I see
a really good observation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They say, well, you got to play three sports. Why? Well, because your feet move different. They don't move different. What do you mean move different? Mm-hmm. I don't get that. You know, I understand what you're saying.
Sure.
But for me, and when I reflect on it, it wasn't because I played three sports. I learned how to compete against the linebacker.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how to compete against the 6'5" center. I learned how to compete against the fast guard. I learned how to compete walking into Philly playing football and walking into Philly playing basketball. I'm going, right. Oh, man, this is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So more important for me, it was the ability to kind of see different athletes more than my body moving.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the versatility and playing different sports, we like to emphasize that there's a cross-training mentality to how people go about their preparation. And we treat the mind no differently. Mm-hmm. We want to cross-train the mind in the most aggressive manner, so an athlete in that crunch time has that ability to be more flexible, to have more endurance. When you think about, you said you need to be a little crazy. What do you actually mean by that?
You got to be able to think on your feet and take the chance, and just like make the mistake and get back. Okay, go ahead and make another mistake and come back. Okay,
right.
And it's like a lot of guys will be a little too cautious. Like, should I go to the right, go to the left? I don't know.
Yeah.
But no, I'm like, well, you got to go to the right, go hard, and if it's a mistake, get back to center and do it again.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about, like as far as take a chance.
You think that's being taught?
No, yeah. You can't teach that. They're not teaching that.
Yeah.
They're teaching cautiousness. I see it.
Why?
Why? Because it's safe.
That doesn't make sense. Yeah, but that doesn't make sense to me.
But it doesn't make sense to me either. They're teaching just safe. They're teaching, hey, be safe. Okay, because if you're on the fence, you're nowhere.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're not on one side or the other. Right. And what happened, the safe thing to do as a coach is not take a side.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think a lot of times the kids are, they play like that.
Right.
They play and it's not good. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I think I made my best decisions when I made mistakes.
Tell me more about that, because I'm wondering about in your career, like you're talking from this experience where these new kids, new coaches coming up, maybe don't have that type of experience. So what about your experiences kind of have shaped like, yeah, you got to kind of take those risks.
Well, I was surrounded by some really good coaches coming up. I was Skip Wilson. Even in high school, I had great coaches in high school. I mean, these guys put the fear of God in you to compete. And I think that helped as well.
Are you allowed to do that anymore?
Yeah, exactly. And so what I'm talking about is the fact that when I got to A-ball and I got converted from an outfielder to a third baseman, they told me to go get every ground ball I can get to. And they said, go get every ground ball you can get to. That's your role as a third baseman. So they allowed me and told me, basically, make the mistake. The more mistakes you make, the more you're going to learn what you can and can't do.
Right.
So I knew after the third step, I'm not getting that ground ball because I took the fourth, fifth, and sixth step and didn't get it and fell and tripped and hit the shortstop. So I made those. I was allowed to make those mistakes, and I learned quicker. Mm-hmm. Just like when you teach hitting, swing at everything.
Mm.
Swing at everything. And like the hitting coaches today, hey, swing at strikes. What do you mean swing at strikes? Swing at everything so you know what you can't do.
Right. Mm.
Because you just might be able to hit a ball that's not a strike.
Mm-hmm.
Because a strike zone is a ball you can hit.
So let's kind of get into that a little bit. When you think about the streak You know, you got to respect the streak. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't do anything to disrupt it. Or the other dreaded S word, the slump, mm-hmm. you know, that we're not allowed to talk about. We can only mention.
Right.
Between the streak and the slump, we have to assume that mentally as a hitter, you're either doing something that's effortless, like flow state, mm-hmm. that maybe you're not thinking about anything at all, or at a slump, you're thinking about all the wrong things. Mentally, Jeff, what do you think is going on with the hitter who is just killing it?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. Mm. They're just waking up. Their clothes aren't wrinkled. They get a green light to the ballpark. Nothing's going on. You know what I mean? I love that. Nothing is going on. Yeah. And they show up and the bat feels good. The pine tar feels good. The batting gloves just slip on. Mm. Their clothes are dry. You know? Mm-hmm. And it's just the way it is, man. I think that flow state is something that, like we talked about imagery and visualization.
Yes.
I think you put yourself in that mode.
Describe that.
Like,
what do you mean?
Like, I can make this feel good. I can make this batting glove feel good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This batting glove is going to feel good. I made a decision that mm-hmm. this feels good. And we talked about a couple of times before where, you know, be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yes.
Oh, this is uncomfortable. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, this feels good because it's uncomfortable. Right. And you're like, what the hell are you talking about?
Right.
And that's where you convince yourself, talk yourself, this is fine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when you're getting into when you're not swinging the bat so good, you're not comfortable with being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And for me, what I see with players who are struggling, they're trying. I'm going to get a strike. I'm going to try to get a perfect pitch. That perfect pitch doesn't come.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. And I heard from J.J. Hardy. He said it best. And we're talking to him about having a discussion about a slump. And I said, well, what do you do? And he goes, when I'm in a slump, I swing because I want to know where I'm at with my swing. I don't want to take pitches. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make me better. Swinging makes me better. I'm like, wow, that's pretty good stuff.
Mm-hmm. So here, let's just, and this is another clean segue, is to when you're talking about swinging or not swinging or taking pitches, you know, with in the face of the sabermetric world and how it has evolved and the dominance that it's taken over in baseball, Saber being Society for American Baseball Research. And really, we owe a lot to you and your suggestions of a lot of things that we were doing years ago of trying to find that more all-encompassing metric that represents what we do, which we now call BioQ. When you think about slugging percentage or on-base percentage, they're starting to take into account walks mm-hmm. as quality at-bats. But yet when we're talking about hitting, and I guess I'm dating myself a little bit, I always used to think about, well, who has the best batting average?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the key difference now. What's your take on that?
I think it all has a place in it. I really do think the sabermetrics does work. I think it tells a valuable story. Mm-hmm. But what I have learned along the way, it's that walking a base on balls doesn't make you a good hitter.
Right.
Mm.
Good hitters walk.
So explain that to me.
What happens is that, like, if I'm a good hitter, I know my strike zone. I know what I can and can't hit. If that ball's an inch, I know I can't hit that ball one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good hitters take pitches. Okay, they know what they can and cannot hit.
Right.
So for me to go up there and look for a walk, I mean, good hitters don't, I mean, walking doesn't mm-hmm. make you a good hitter.
Right.
I'm not going to say take a walk. You know, Walter Matthau, mm-hmm. Bad News Bears, get a walk.
Right.
Okay,
right.
How do you do that? How do you get one?
Right.
What happens mm-hmm. if the guy throws a strike? Will you take mm-hmm. it? I'm trying to get a walk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, why are you trying to do that? Mm-hmm. So for me, walking doesn't make you a good hitter. Hitters walk.
Right.
Right. So it means you're...
If you know what the hell you're doing, you're going to walk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you know what you're doing, you're going to swing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference today. So now when you take it back, and I had this conversation with the Orioles guys, okay, what's more important? What happens first?
Mm-hmm.
The metrics work. They work. Okay, I'm all into this. But what has to happen first? The player gives you the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't we nurturing the hitter? We're nurturing the numbers, not the hitter. So whatever the numbers say will not happen unless you teach the hitter. Simple.
Mm.
Thus, numbers being the byproduct of
a good major swing.
Investing
and that's what I've said all along. Hey, the numbers are great. The launch angle, that's all good. Mm-hmm. It is a measurement, not a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, the numbers that they're using today, quite frankly, I think are owner-friendly because now they can compare you
right.
and go, no, 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 no. Okay, look, this is where your numbers compare. I'm not giving you $15 million. I'll give you $12 million. But now I have a better, the owners are better educated with statistics. Yeah. And everything flows off of the statistics today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Before, back in the day when we were playing, oh, he's a nice guy. He had a good average. I'd give him 10, mm-hmm. 10, 15 million. Oh, well, what about the guy in LA? Who cares? Just give him. Now they have some significant, precise numbers to measure. But it doesn't happen unless the player has a good major league approach.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I've said that to the people. And it's not a mechanic.
Mm-hmm. Right. So let's talk about the approach, because in your role and what you've done for so many major league organizations, with the Orioles, with the Pirates, with the White Sox, in your role as hitting instructor or hitting coach, talk to me about the emphasis that you would make with a ball player as far as to their approaches to hitting. Mm-hmm. You did some work with Ken Revisa, the late great Ken Revisa. Talk to me about how you were first introduced to him in your career and what you've learned from him and what you've taken to the hitters that you've worked with.
Well, I met Ken in 1988. I thought I was on my way out. I had 3 years that were subpar in my eyes. And again, getting back to not knowing what development meant, where I was on a food chain. Mm. And I thought to myself, okay, this is going to be my last year. Mm-hmm. I'm not walking out of this, but I'm not leaving spring training on a team. All of a sudden, Joe Maddon, that's Ken's guy, introduces Ken Revisa to us. And he takes us into this.
This is when you're with who?
The Angels, the California Angels.
California.
I just wanted that clarification. I just wanted to hear that roll off your tongue.
Yeah, that's good. And so I remember, you know, Joe, to make a long story short, introducing us to Ken Revisa, and Ken Revisa introducing himself to us. And he said, I'm going to take a visualization, you know, an imagery. I had never heard of the word. And make a long story short, he takes us out in center field one morning. And he introduces visualization to us, and it was a light. You talk about a light go on. Mm-hmm. It was incredible, absolutely incredible. I'm shortening up the story.
Yeah.
But it's an absolutely incredible experience that I had. And one of the things, and as you heard the first part of this commentary, was how negative I was, and that's what Ken said. He goes, baseball players are negative people. Athletes are negative people because all we dwell on is the negative. And one of the stories that taken out of that was, he goes, go back to the best time you ever had in baseball. Go back to the where you felt you were at your best. And about 45 seconds later, he goes, all right, everybody open up your eyes. How many guys can get there? None of us could get there. None of us could get back to the best when we were the best. That's how negative we are. Now, here we are sitting in a professional baseball field in the spring training in professional baseball, and we don't think we're the best. He said, listen, you can go back as far back as T-ball or Little League because it's relative. The feeling is relative.
Right.
So I went back to DeFazio plumbing. You know, and that's when I thought I was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't, and all of a sudden I'm like, wow, this is incredible. Speed up the story. I get it now. I make the team. I'm going to Midland, Texas. And in Midland, Texas, we were about maybe 100 yards from the stadium. And I'll never forget this day. And most players, I would assume, they don't forget that day when they got it. And this was the moment that I knew I had a chance. I'm walking to the ballpark, and when I tell you I stopped in my tracks, I literally stopped in my tracks. Because as baseball, as people, as professionals, we don't turn off. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I mean, you go home, you think about psychology and sports. And
sure.
I go home, mm-hmm. I think about baseball. The guys in Wall Street, they go home and think about Wall Street. Right. That's simple. So we don't turn off. I'm walking to the ballpark, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. My whole body tingled, like when your arms go to sleep. My whole body tingled, and I'm like, that's what they're talking about. That's what they're talking about. Oh, my God. So I had this imagery going on, and this imagery wouldn't shut off.
Right.
Mm.
It never shut off for me. Next thing, I'm like, that's what it is. So I sped up. I got on the batting tee, put it on the field. And I remember, never forget, Mr. Velarde, Randy Velarde's father, who played with the Yankees for a lot of years. I asked him, Mr. Velarde, would you mind if he was cutting it? He was the groundkeeper. And I said, you mind if I hit off the tee? And he goes, yeah, I'll go take my lunch. So I went on, I used a visual. I was using my visualization on the batting tee. Mm-hmm. That was it.
That's when you made the connection.
That's when I was in. That's right. When I was convinced. I you know what? There's something more than just talent.
Yeah. Mm.
There's something more than just physical talent. And that's when I was, man, I am in.
Do you think that's tapping into, though, some hidden talent that you did have? Because I found that not everyone can get into that visualization state. People find resistance to get there. What, maybe just thinking about it, what about you allowed you to get into that space? Was it your level of acceptance of it? Your thinking about how you viewed Ken? Like, what were you, what allowed you to accept and like be like, okay, visualization is something I can work with?
I think both, you know, the acceptance of Ken, most importantly. Mm-hmm. And I, again, like we talked earlier, my back was against the wall. Mm-hmm. I had no other option. Mm-hmm. I had no other go-to, so I'm gonna try this. And getting into the coaching part of it, I trusted the people I was around. I trusted Bruce Hines. I trusted Joe Madden. I trusted Joe Coleman. I trusted the Latchman brothers. I trusted these people. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I knew they were sincerely trying to help me. So I went in.
Mm-hmm.
You think that trust, Jeff, is a byproduct of the times in which you played? When you look at how professional sports, perhaps baseball specifically, has grown, do you think the same level of trust exists between players and coaches and managers and GMs?
Not today. I mean,
Just the business?
It's just the business side of it. And we talk about it all the time as colleagues, older colleagues now, to where we had no other coach besides the coaches we were with.
Mm.
There was no cell phones. Okay, so when you looked up and you saw Joe Madden and you looked up and you saw Eddie Rodriguez, they were your coaches.
Yeah.
Today, if you don't trust a coach, you make a phone call, you make a text. Hey, Mr. Hitting Guy that I work with, what do you think of this? And so you trusted more. You had to trust. Mm-hmm. You know, what we talk about all the time where we're on the, you know, 6-hour bus rides talking to the guy next to you on a bus. We're telling him stuff like, I wouldn't even tell my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And here are we telling a stranger from, you know, Seattle. It's like, God, I can't believe I just told this guy that story. Now it's like, no, you know, they get on the bus, they get on their phone, they call their moms, their dads, their girlfriends,
mm-hmm.
and they become their outlet. Where we had, this is it, man. This is the best you got. Mm-hmm. So take it or leave it.
Do you think that has gotten in the way of like the, you hear about the great teams and team building and how they all connect? And how technology, as you say, everyone gets on their phones, everyone's doing their individual thing. You think that makes it more difficult for the really great teams, one, to become great through that team building, and then two, stay together?
Yeah, I really do think it's tough because you can't have – when you – and I don't know if this is the right word. I'm not even going to try to say it. When you have a great team, nothing comes in that clubhouse. And nothing leaves that clubhouse.
Mm.
You know, and I know businesses try to do the same thing on, we have a great team. And when you get to have a great team, you need loyalty, you need friendship, okay? You need all that. And sometimes today, you know, you see it in the sports today, well, he's not me, I'm going to call my agent, okay? I'm not happy here, I'm going to flip off in the media and say this on Twitter and say, come on, man. Mm-hmm. You don't do that. And you'll never see a championship team do that. I didn't hear about the Buccaneers all year.
Mm.
All of a sudden, like, oh my God, they showed up again.
Yeah. Right,
that one guy showed up again.
Yeah,
you know, and all these great teams, they show up, but you don't hear about them because they're not in the media. They're not throwing stuff out there. They're keeping all their stuff in house,
mm-hmm.
and they vent to their buddy. They don't vent on Twitter.
Right.
They don't vent over here.
Is that starting at the top, though? Is that made abundantly clear upon arrival that you're part of this close-knit culture that you just don't do that, or is it something else?
I don't know. I just know that, you know, I think general managers and managers try to stop it, and every meeting that they have, hey guys, let's get this together, let's stay together here. It doesn't happen because there's always somebody that went ready to push that send button and just. Everything collapses, and it's amazing how quick it happens. It doesn't take long.
No, it doesn't. Well, we've seen that in our own backyard, mm-hmm. right, with the Eagles and Carson Wentz and, you know, Doug Peterson and Howie Roseman and all of that cast of characters. And there's it's really hard to believe that we won a Super Bowl in 2017.
Yeah, 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
did you take it back, and did you hear anything that year? Didn't hear anything.
No.
Only positive, really.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So everything was support, inside.
Faith.
Right.
Yeah, they believed in each
other. The underdog, the dog masks, and hungry dogs run faster.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and they stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it takes. That's what it takes. And you know, sometimes one gets out. I mean, all the cliches about you know, the weakest link and things like that. One,
right.
You know, so it happens. Mm-hmm. And it happens quick.
Right. Michael, if you could bring up that clip of Pete Rose on the MLB Network, I want to get Jeff's take on this. Mm-hmm. So obviously, as a hitting coach, you know, philosophies, the streak versus the slump. Everyone's got an opinion. Mm-hmm. What should you be doing? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that you need to adjust at the plate? How do you go about it? So there's this clip, MLB Network, it was a few years back with A-Rod, and I think it was Frank Thomas. Mm-hmm. And Pete Rose, and they were asking him about what he actually did differently. Let's take a look. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that?
He's awesome.
He's awesome. I mean, I don't know how anyone can bash Pete Rose yeah. when he's talking about hitting.
Right.
But
you see, the authenticity of it today, that doesn't happen today.
Mm. Why not?
Because it's too simple.
Mm.
It's too simple. You know,
What about keep it simple, stupid? What about KISS, man?
It can't.
Come on.
There's too much information.
Yeah.
There's too much information. I'm going to try these 15 things, and I'm not going to trust myself.
Mm-hmm.
Back when these guys were playing, back when we were playing, you know, Pete Rose, well, obviously well before myself, they figured it out. Mm. Today, we are players aren't being coached today. Players are being told today.
Mm. Mm.
Okay, what I'm gonna do? Why don't you up there and do this? Why don't you go out there and figure it out? Because mm-hmm. you need to figure it out. And they're not doing that today. They're going to the video. They're going to the statistics. And statistics are something that happened in the past. It's information that you can use possibly, but statistics are a memory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's almost like when the manager knows that he's gonna pinch hit, pinch run. Why'd you do that? The numbers were against him. No, he won't. It's 50-50. It's 50-50. He gets a hit or he doesn't. You know, we have a hunch. And so we can go back and forth with that. But when back up until the last couple of years, we're telling players what to do. We're not coaching them what to do. Now, what's the cliche about teach a man how to fish, you feed him for life? What's
yeah.
that one?
Yeah, right. teach a man or catch a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach a man a fish, he'll eat for life.
Same thing.
He'll for a lifetime.
Okay, yeah. I can tell you how to get a hit. I can figure this out. And get yourself on a fastball and go.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But let me teach you how to hit so we can create some sustainability.
Right, but that's hard. That's challenging. That's difficult. You're gonna, it takes time. You're going to fail.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears associated right. with that. Yeah. Which
it's not immediate.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like they don't want that, man. They don't want that. They want that fast. They want it fast. Then they want it now.
Do you mm-hmm. think they make the connection? Because when I think fast, I think burnout.
Mm-hmm.
I think like we can get that. Let's look at the Eagles because we can actually say that right now. They kind of flamed out,
mm-hmm.
right? They made their move. They made their push. Everything aligned. Things happened for a reason. There was a ton of persistence, overcome of injury, team first, and we win the Super Bowl. And again, 3 years, complete flame out, complete. Whereas now you have key players that are gone or on their way out,
mm-hmm.
and the entirety of the coaching staff is gone. You have a new head coach. You have a new OC. You have a new DC. When you think about getting there quickly or that immediate gratification, mm-hmm. do you think they're making the connection around the conference room in the boardroom table saying, you know what, it doesn't matter. We still want this gratification, this success yesterday, even if we flame out in 3 years.
Well, it takes time. You know, that's the problem. Everybody got to understand it. It mm-hmm. takes time to form that. I don't think I mean, maybe there is. I mean, the Buccaneers, I guess, are a perfect example. You put a team together and they win the first year. So that's kind of, I would think.
They did have a ton of talent, though.
Right.
As their head coach, Arians, said very succinctly, talking about the value of Tom Brady, mm-hmm. he taught everyone how to win. These kids didn't know how to win.
Right.
We were completely saturated with talent. They didn't know how to win. You come in Brady, you come in the commitment, the culture, the work ethic. And hey, now everyone sees the light, Jordan effect, which yeah. we've talked about right. in mm-hmm. past shows, making everyone better, everyone raising their game. You know, this the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Mm-hmm. He was just the last piece.
Yeah, on the baseball front, that definitely happens. I mean, you bring these guys in together, and you gotta like these people. Sometimes they partially rebuild, they rebuild, totally rebuild. Like the Orioles are rebuilding mm-hmm. right now. The Yankees never rebuild. You know, they're that team you're talking about. We have to win now. And so what they did, I remember being with the Yankees, and the Yankees, when I was there, and when I look at them, they always had good people. They always had good people. They never had great players. They always had those good support guys like the Bernie Williams. If Bernie Williams went someplace else, Bernie Williams would have been good, but not as impactful as he was for the Yankees. Mm. Jeter would have been good, but he fit. He mm-hmm. fit perfectly. You talk about Tino Martinez. You talk about Girardi and Posada. They all were the good guys with good talent. And obviously, there's Hall of Famers there too, but I think they all fed off of each other. And I think that happens in all sports, or it should happen in all sports, where mm-hmm. you can't, like you're saying, you have the talent, right. and you bring in Brady. Right. You know, the Yankees had a talent, and they bring in Clemens. They bring in Cohn, mm-hmm. you know, and then just puts them over the top. And so I think you have to have good people as well as good talent.
Yeah, I've been reading a book on war, and a big element of that is how an individual is much more difficult to predict because they can change rapidly versus an entire army. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time for them to change. And so for organizations, I think individuals can change quickly, but these larger organizations are these organizations who have a long-standing history, mm-hmm. it's taking them a lot longer to make certain changes or recognize certain things to develop and change with those times as well.
It makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. It definitely makes a lot of sense.
When you think about, you know, just to kind of revisit that Rose bit and how he's approaching hitting and making very minor adjustments in being around the plate but never changing your swing, from our perspective, we're always trying to over encourage that the environment that you're playing in, you know, one of the things that you said to me a long time ago that I've actually quoted really all around the United States, your check is in the mail for that one, is that, you know, often I have it down to a pat. Often when you go into Yankee Stadium, it is 1-0 before the game starts. Mm-hmm. So when you think about us trying to teach athletes, performers, really, that the foundation of everything is learning how to be calm, which you found through visualization, through guided imagery. When you look at a hitter in your evaluation of talent, how do you know, Jeff, that a hitter is in that calm space? What's their tell, like in poker?
It's their eyes.
Their eyes.
You look at their eyes. You look at their just their whole presence. When they walk in, It's an it that you have as a coach, similar to where it's an it you have as a player. Like, that guy got it. As a coach, you can say, you can figure that out. Mm-hmm. Okay, you just see him. And then what do you see? I don't know. I don't know what I see, but I see it. He's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, other guys, you see there and you see them squandering. Like, they're walking around rapid. They're fidgety. They can't get right. Mm-hmm. But the guy who walks in, he's calm.
His poised. Eyes, mm-hmm.
His eyes are pierced. His eyes aren't wide, you know, and you're like, you know, everything he does is just, there's a purpose for their, they walk in the clubhouse and there's a purpose as soon as they walk in, and it's like, those guys, they're beautiful.
Now, mm-hmm. what you call purpose, we call deliberate, mm-hmm. right? Because we're all about this concept of deliberate practice. Mm-hmm. And one of the clips that's on your website, jeffmanto.com, you talk about cage management, mm-hmm. and you talk about putting the ball in the back of the cage. Talk to me a little bit about that philosophy and what that means.
What that means is, again, just as you just said, there's a purpose to the cage. Oftentimes, you'll see kids walk in the cage and they just swing. They go in there to swing. There's no plan as to what they're going to do today. Mm-hmm. And as we talk about how to practice, okay, there's a way to practice, there's a way to prepare, and that gives you the discipline. There's also on that practice is a discipline, and the discipline is to put the ball in the back of the net. What I like to do is give the kids, okay, listen, nobody wants to be told what to do all the time. Mm-hmm. And for me, I tell the kids, if you can get this ball off the tee to the back of the net, your swing's fine. That's too simple. Mm-hmm. But don't have to drop my shoulder, drop my knee, put my hands in this thing. No, I'm telling you, if you can put this ball to the back of the net, you're fine. And then I sit there and I watch it, and it's just a great evolution on how this player becomes himself.
Right,
and he
right.
takes responsibility.
They're adapting themselves to right. try to hit to the back.
Because everybody swings different. Everybody's body's different. Everybody has a different physical ability. Some have longer arms, shorter arms. Mm-hmm. Who's got the lower center of gravity. These are the things you look at as a coach. And this is why guys hit in certain part of the lineups mm-hmm. than others. And this is why guys strike out because they're long, they're short. And there's a lot of different reasons. But if the purpose and the discipline is to get the ball in the back of the net, you don't have to coach them. And they coach themselves. And the best thing in the world, as we know as adults, is when you do something by yourself. When the accomplishment was made and you did it by yourself. Well, as a coach, that's our goal.
Right.
Is to make them think that they did it by themselves.
Right. Mm. I don't know if you truly connect with the psychological elements of your philosophy when you explain it the way that you do. Mm-hmm. Because you're often, you're very humble and you're very quick to say, yo, that's your job. That's not mine. Yeah. I don't know anything about that. But you do. Because what you're really talking about is self-awareness mm-hmm. and self-regulation. You're asking your hitters, that the phrase that I've seen you do on the number of projects that we've collaborated on when I've seen you at work is figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Your figure it out is, you can do this.
Right.
I can tell, it's everything that you're saying. I can tell you what to do. I can tell you how to, I can show you how to get a hit. Right. It goes back to the fishing, right?
Right.
You're teaching them how to fish. And what it is you have the ability to self-correct. Right.
It's more so you're more so teaching them how to fail too, because then it's adaptation as a result of that failure. Right. Right. It's, I'm not hitting the back. So, okay, maybe I have to choke up. Maybe I have to swing down. Maybe I have to, whatever it might be. And they're trying to figure that out, which gives them the resources too.
Right.
That when they're, on the field, they have to adapt and adjust to the pitcher that's coming at them.
Exactly right. And in that, we'll tell, I teach them what a batted ball tells you, a foul ball. Learn right then. The foul ball goes this way. You did this. You probably did this. If the ball goes that way, you probably did this. Okay, so you have to self-correct. Now, mm-hmm. the thing about it is, I think this. Every place you play is relative. I think if you play in a college World Series, it's the same as playing in a big league World Series. I think if you play in a little league World Series, it's just as good as playing in a big league World Series. The stress levels are the same.
Yeah.
If you tell mm-hmm. a 12-year-old you're going to go to Williamsport, they start breathing heavy and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think they don't hear when under stress. I would assume you don't mm-hmm. hear. If you're good, you don't hear it. If you're bad, you hear it. But if you do hear, you got to try to, okay, I know what I'm doing. I got this. I figured this out. That ball in here. And this is through discussion. This is why I call my, when I work with players, I don't call them lessons. It's a consultation.
Hmm.
Because we're not going to put a ball on a tee and hit or flip a ball and hit it. It's a discussion. Like, well, you did that because of this. What did you think? And then what you do is you try to lead them up to the answer, and they walk out and go, I told that guy what to do. Mm-hmm. Like, you're going to get out of here. Mm-hmm.
So, the big baseball quote, when you think of Yogi Berra, is you can't think and hit at the same time, right? What's your take on that?
I think it's cute. It worked.
So, no,
I think it's okay.
Let's dive into that, though.
And I think, Yogi Berra, he is right, but you got to think. You got to think.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking about?
You're thinking about where this ball's coming off that plane, not the ball, the linear plane. Does it leave that elevation?
Mm-hmm.
Did I see his hand turn? Did I see him leg kick? Did it go higher? Excuse me. Did it go higher than normal? Did it stay lower than normal? Mm-hmm. Because there are certain pitches that cannot be thrown physically
mm-hmm.
without that change.
Without the change in your foot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm sure the great pitchers can do this. But if a kid leg kicks, okay, high in the stretch,
mm-hmm.
he has a good chance of throwing a curveball because that's what they do. Kids, they try to help themselves and they try to get on top of the ball.
Right, really get up and over it.
Right, the guy slide steps, it's a sinker slider.
Mm-hmm.
So all I have to do is decide, am I going left, am I going right here, where am I at? Okay, so yes, you do have to think and hit. I get what Yogi was saying.
Well, I think that's so interesting too because with my height, I was never really the best hitter and what I would think about is, did I hit it or did I not? And I'm mm-hmm. focusing more so on the outcome of hitting it or not hitting it versus you're talking about focusing on the whole process
mm-hmm.
of where the ball is coming from, even the movements of the pitcher, where that angle, the spin, all that stuff is where you're thinking versus did I hit it or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that shifts the entire thinking of the player, I feel like, from the outcome to the process of batting.
But it's there's so much information that goes into this. I mean, right now, what I do now with this with the visual tee, the batting tee, is we do weekday games or weekend pitchers. We do the Friday night pitcher or do the weekday, the non-conference pitcher. Because now we're teaching these college hitters, you know, how to get their body speed ready for a midweek game. Because a midweek game, probably they're going to throw the freshman, the sophomore to get innings in. They're not going to throw the good ones because they want to win the conference games.
Right.
So we got the Friday night guy where we look at something different. Okay, then the midweek guy, or our body speed's going to get slower because the fastball now becomes relative. I have to get ready for a 98-mile-an-hour fastball on Friday night or an 85-mile-an-hour midweek fastball. But the fastball's a fastball, but you got to get ready for a different fastball. And that, the kids, when you start talking to the kids, like, I never thought about that. Well, you know, the midweek guy is the guy, that's the layup. Okay, that you got to take care of the midweek guy. You know, that's where you get your three hits, your four hits. Those two games you play during the week, then the weekend you take your lumps.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's how guys get drafted all the time. It's hysterical. We get guys coming from the draft. And major colleges, any major college you can think about, these kids come in and go, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm hitting 210. Hey, Mick, how am I hitting 210? How are you hitting 210? Dude, you hit 210 all year in college. No, I never hit 210 in college. Yes, you did. I said, here's what you did. I said, you hit 340 during a week. Okay, then a weekend came, you hit a .180. Okay, so when the pitching got better, you got worse. Right. Just figure it out, man. We'll take care of it. We know why you're here.
Right.
So that just gives them a little kick in the pants.
So go ahead.
No.
So I was going to talk about, so you're talking about this skill too. A lot of times we've been talking about effort and people willing to put in an effort, but we find that people who have that high level of skill don't necessarily put in that effort. They're not really thinking about that as much. How do you approach a player who has some talent, but, you know, is kind of just laying back in it, and you have to now work with him because he's part of the Major League Ball Club?
Well, you wait for him to come to you. If they're successful, and let them be. The one thing you don't want to do, in my opinion, as a coach, is go solicit your information. I think the best coaches is laying the weeds, okay? If it's almost like the Dalai Lama, okay? When the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Right.
Okay, and that happens more times than not.
Is that more Charlie Manuel?
Yeah, that's more Charlie. Charlie, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I've heard you tell stories about him.
Yeah, he's great like that.
Yeah.
Come here. I got information, man. I got the information. If you want it, I got it. If you don't need it, don't need it. But and when you're doing that, when you're dealing with these high-end guys, what you do with these guys is you guide them. And you just guide them. And for me, when I'm at that level, I have the simplest answer. I don't get complicated with them. I had the opportunity to work with some high-end hitters, and the success I've had with them was because I said less, you know, because they don't want to hear it. They just want to hear something positive. You know, if they ask a question, give them an honest answer. Are my hands here? No. And when you say it, for me, how my coaching style is, if I notice something, I'll say it walking past them because they don't want to be confronted. These superstars do not want to be confronted as far as, like, especially, you know, you see guys all the time, and I watch these games and you see the hitting coach talking to the superstar on the bench, like, don't do it on the bench. Just do it under the tunnel. They do it under the tunnel because that guy does not want to be looked at like, oh my God, this guy's telling me what to do.
Right.
And the other guys that want to work, you work. You know, you make sure they're working smart. A lot of guys will come in and just hit and for the sake of hitting. And there's no purpose. You know, I'm going to, you know, grudge hit. I was 0-4. I'll show that 0-4. I'm going to come here and hit for an extra hour. That makes no sense either. You're just reinforcing negative stuff. So you got to coach. You got to coach.
Again, the psychology behind coaching and some of the things that I hear you say of how you approach someone, how you go about that communication is so incredibly relevant to all persons in whatever job that they're doing. Whether they like to be, you know, spoken to directly or that confrontation is something that they don't align with. How do you regulate that? Is that just pure observation, Jeff, through you watching them practice and then kind of sizing them? Are you profiling all of your players in any way?
Yeah, I really am. I'll start a conversation just to learn. Tell me about yourself. You know, then you can go in and you think of some kind of analogies that they want to talk about. There's often times where when you start talking to a player, hey, this is general conversation. Hey, what's your hobbies? well, I like to fish, I like to hunt, I like to do that. That's good. That's good. I know that's awesome stuff. And then what happens, in your conversation, you might start off your teaching day, hey, I got this fish the other day. Did you see this one? All of a sudden you bring them down. You know, it's not intense anymore. You softened it up. You softened the cut. You're preparing to have a major conversation, okay, but you softened it up. Hey, we talk about fishing. Yeah, by the way, last night, that 0-2 fastball, where were you? Ah, man, I was. And then you start the dialogue that way.
Right. Is country music playing in the background?
You know, and then you ask them about their family, ask them about their kids. Mm-hmm. Everybody likes to be asked about their kids. Everybody. Mm-hmm. My son's doing this, my daughter's doing this, my wife's. And you ask them.
Sure.
And you're always. You want to know how to coach them, because coaching is not just going through skill, put your hand out. You got to coach the person.
Right, the relationship.
And the coaching's a relationship. So you have somebody who's hard, you know, you better.
There's such a human element to what you're saying, right? And you're saying coaching the person. With the human element of what we're trying to accomplish and how we help people perform, why do you think that so often gets overlooked just because you're a pro athlete?
They're afraid.
Yeah,
they're afraid to have dialogue with them. Mm-hmm. They're afraid to coach them. They're nervous about it. I don't know. I mean, that's you know, they're just that's the way you got to do it.
Right.
You know, I know the best coaches I had know everything about my family. Mm.
Do you think that helps you shift to the different personalities of the players, like understanding who they are? Right. Instead of just coaching them one way, do you feel like you have to coach them different ways depending on the player?
Exactly. Yes, you do. You really do. We coach kids differently from the Dominican. Mm. Then we do the kids from California. Then we do the kids from the Midwest. Then we do the kids from Florida. Then the kids from New England. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a way about them. You know, the Dominican players, they are the most passionate people. They're the most passionate people to coach. And with the Dominican players, all you have to do is take a picture of them and show them what they look like in a uniform. And, hey, man, look at this. And they just light up. They love to see themselves in a picture.
Yeah.
So that's how you coach the Latin players. They love it. And they, hey, tell me about your family. They love telling you about their family.
La familia.
Oh, they love it. So, and that's how you coach them. Then you have their trust. And the kids from California, depending on if you're from California, if you're from Cali, that's LA down. Mm-hmm. If you're from California, that's LA up. Gotcha. Okay. You're from Cali or California? Oh, California. Where at? San Francisco? Yeah, my player. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to coach those kids differently. Right. Kids from the Northeast, tell them, right? You shoot them straight. This is it. This is the way it's going to be. This is how it's going to be. This is what's going to end up happening if you don't make this adjustment. The kids from Texas, they love it. They love talking baseball. Mm-hmm. Okay. Kids from Northeast, talk about the Yankees. Talk about the Yankees. The kids from Northeast, they know everything about the Yankees. Mm-hmm. That's what they're brought up with.
Sure.
You're talking about the flexibility of the coach too, right? We talked a little bit about the adaptation of the player, but you're also talking about for you, right, as an established coach, your level of flexibility and having to adjust to your coaching style.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, there's some drills that you try to go into a coaching day. You have this plan, but you have to be able to adjust the plan. And you walk in and you're going to, with player A, you have this, I want to do this progression with them. You know, we're going to map out the day. Okay, I'm going to do this progression. As soon as you recognize him, you go, you know what? No, he's not in the mood for this today. I can tell. Mm. And you just let it go. And you just go to plan B. And you have a plan, always have a plan B. And you know, so you got to adapt. You got to adapt.
In your efforts to work with all of these different types of hitters and their philosophies, and you're kind of, again, customizing your approaches. And then so often in today's world, I think it's about customization, right? Hunter mentioned earlier about how kids try to play just one position, or they just want to do one thing really, really well. Do you think the customization, while required, reinforces to these kids that they can do just one thing? Or do you think that that customization from you as a coach is really their best shot at growing and learning?
Well, it's the observation and realizing, hey, man, this is your best shot.
Yeah,
you have to be able to do all this, and because you look at the player, there are some guys who just fit one spot, and that's it. You know, you got a left-handed hitter, left-handed thrower. You know, hey man, you first base. Sorry, this is where you fit.
Right.
But everything else, you have to make them. You know, you got to make them flexible. You have to, because in today's game, you know, they're starting to draft multi-position players. Not everybody is, a shortstop. They'd label it, for organizational purposes, but you got to be able to adapt and be flexible.
Yeah. So, Michael, let's bring up that clip from Bull Durham. I heard that Jeff referred to himself as Nuke Lelouch earlier. And this is one of the more popular scenes from Bull Durham, where Crash is talking about what it takes to get to the show and the difference between batting 250 and 300. I want to get your little take on this.
I'm going to the show. Who's the first person you told when you were going to the show?
Oh, my father.
There you go. Mm-hmm. So when you hear that, the difference between 250 and 300 and breaking it down, it's almost a setup for Sabermetrics, because he's talking about the numbers and the number of weeks and number of hits per week. And
it's pretty cool stuff. I mean, it's absolutely true. And that's where you get the self-talk sometimes as a hitter. You'll take everything. I hit that ball good. Who cares? That thing hits the grass. That's a hit.
That's a hit.
That's a hit. I don't care how I get the hit. It's a hit, because it's so hard to get a base hit that you do take all of them.
Yeah.
You take all of them.
How hard is it to get a base hit?
Oh, my God.
It's in the major leagues?
It's awful.
Because everyone says the most difficult thing in professional sports is hitting a baseball.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on that?
I honestly agree. I mean, it's just like there's, when you look at the field and go, my God, look how big this is. Mm-hmm. When you get up to the plate, there's no green. You don't see green. And there's some times where it's so difficult. It is like the stress of it, the planning of it. You got the next thing you know, you got these guys out in center field that are really like, they run the 60-yard dash like it's nothing. They're all track stars out in the outfield. They got these shortstops. They're about 150 pounds. They can get across the infield. If this ball doesn't hit the grass, if this ball doesn't hit a line drive, if this ball's not a line drive, you're out.
Yeah.
I don't care who you look at. Andrew Jones. I remember watching Andrew Jones, and we all had that. He wasn't even in the camera. There was a batted ball hitting Yankees. They might have been in the World Series. Batted ball hitting left center field, and you think it's a double. All of a sudden, out of the camera, here comes Andrew Jones. He was playing in right center. And he runs this thing down like it's nothing.
Yeah.
And it's impossible. Mm-hmm.
So when it's so difficult to hit that round ball with that round bat at incredibly high speed, what is it like genuinely as a major league hitter when you start to perform, but you know that you just don't want to mess it up?
That's where you come in.
What is that like as far as, hey, I'm doing this pretty well.
Right.
Do you start to become more self-aware? Like, am I doing the same things? Do I need to keep doing the same things?
You start trying to run with this as long as you can. Like the great hitters, they notice this is supposed to happen. Can you imagine being Mike Trout and walking in every day feeling like you just described? I got this today. Mike Trout walks in the ballpark and goes, I got at least two today. Like that must be a feeling. It is a feeling. Incredible feeling. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of the mortals, it's when you start to hit, you start to run. You start becoming superstitious. You start, I'm going to do the same thing. I need the same BP pitcher. I'm going to do the same routine. You try to recreate that feel, and excuse me, and it's tough to maintain, man. It really is tough to maintain. And you hope to God that you run this thing out for a month. Just please let me do this for a month.
Right.
And then reality hits sometimes.
So you say superstition. There's a saying that it's only superstitious if what you do works.
Right. Yeah.
So was there ever something that you did personally that you felt worked?
Like I still put my left sock on today first. I put my left sock on first every single day since 1985. You believe that?
I do.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Of course I do. Well, it's crazy. It's not crazy if it works.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's there are some superstitions. Yeah, I have a ton of them. Where it's just like it got exhausting after a while. Like, geez, I got to alleviate. Something's got to go.
Did you find them being more a fit of where you were versus something you felt you had to do all the time? Like, would your superstitions change at different places, different teams?
Yes. When there was different things where, you know, I had a routine on the on-deck circle. I had a routine while I was in the hole. Okay, then if I was on the on-deck circle and the hitter swung at the first pitch, well, I knew that I had to end it and I had an ending to my routine. And then when I got in the batter's box, I did this Ken Revisit thing where I cleared out the last at bat. You know, I always
with my feet.
I erased the at bat.
Right.
And then there was one where I got introduced to it in Columbus, Ohio. I struggled in Columbus and I couldn't figure it out. It was not comfortable. And what it was on deck circle, the on deck circle was on a slant for the water, for the drainage. I could never get my last part of my routine, accomplished. So I talked to a sports psychologist, and he said, I explained that to him. And he goes, well, if that happens, that means you're in the right place, the right mind. It's supposed to happen. If they level out this field, you're done. I'm like, right. Wow.
Oh, there we go. Uh-oh. Little Jeff Manto.
Hmm.
Oh, why don't you give me a little play-by-play here?
Right.
The mullet.
Look at
flopping.
The hair. Look at the cabbage in the back.
Do you have vivid memories of your home runs? Like anything above and beyond? Like, obviously, you know, you had the 4 in a row. You also have a record for 5 in 2 days.
5 in 3 days.
5 in 3 days. Mm-hmm. I try to make it 2. You know? any home runs in particular you have fond memories of? You know, whether it was a pitcher or whether it was a setting or a stadium or someone in the fan in the ballpark.
No. There was a lot of them. One story goes where this is a minor league story. The big league ones were nice, but I don't want to talk about the big leaguers. I remember getting David Wells pretty big in Detroit. I got him big in Detroit.
Oh yeah,
and I got Doc Gooden too.
Did you really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And but I didn't know where that ball went. I swung this way, the ball went that way.
But you got it good.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, it was the farthest one I ever hit.
Right.
There was one in it's talking about foreshadowing. There was a make a long story short, we were in Scranton one year. I was playing for Buffalo, and if we lost the game in Scranton, we had a tougher road to the playoffs. In the playoffs, we had to face Doc Holliday, first game.
Okay? Is that right?
If we lost that game, okay. As we're going through it, the Phillies, the Scranton team's beating us. All of a sudden, I see this pitcher warming up in a bullpen, and I yell to Torrey Lovello. I said, "Bad news," and he goes, "What?" I said, "We're going to win this game because look who's getting loose to come close it out." I'm not going to mention any names. Look, and he goes, "Oh no, we're going to win this game, and we're going to have to face Holliday."
Right.
So sure enough, lo and behold, we're down by 2. Okay, I come up at the top of the ninth and hit a 3-run homer off this guy, right? And then
so you kind of called your shot there a little bit, as close as you could.
And there's a couple of them you do, but and then sure enough, we faced Holliday, got our lunch.
But what you're really talking about though is that feeling that so often that if we could capture that lightning in a bottle and sell it, you know, we'd all be gazillionaires. You're talking about, you know, foreshadowing, but you're also talking about an inner confidence. That when you see someone warming up, whether you know that person's history or you know deep down that you've got his number,
right?
That it's not if but when, it's how hard you hit the ball, not the question of are you going to hit it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? How well am I going to barrel the sucker up?
Right. And the funny part about it, when you get to that state or when you know that, they know it too.
Yeah.
And you have the ability to walk up there and go, "It's coming."
Right.
I'm going to sit here. I know that you know,
right?
That I know you're going.
That
to
might be
it.
The Mike Trout feeling that we're talking about, right? Right. You know that I know.
Yeah.
Well, it's Tom Brady's coming down, and with 2 minutes left,
it's over.
We're done.
Right. And you know that. So
it's that feeling that we all had in our gut in 2017 when Brady's got the ball.
Yeah. Hail Mary.
Before the strip sack. It's that feeling. It's coming.
Right.
It's not if but when. Like, brace yourself.
And then I think what happened, I was like the fifth hitter in that inning. That might have been the fifth hit in that inning.
So some other things had to happen for you to get up.
So we're thinking, I knew that he knew. And to avoid it, he tried harder.
Which led him to fail, which got you, pulled you.
Yeah. So that's how I think that all happened.
Yeah.
But that was.
There's a lot of Ken Revisa in you, man. I don't think you realize just when you speak of everything that you, one, have accomplished, but two, your approach to hitting, your philosophy of baseball. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of psych in you.
Well, I tell you what. One of the things we were talking about earlier is like just observing the human behavior. You know, that's the next journey that I'm getting into.
Right.
You know, doing that and being around so many different people and getting myself involved with so many different instances.
Right.
Okay. And just observing all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things they talk about being a bench player, they're good managers, and catchers are good managers. And that's, but what happens if you can observe people?
Right.
You know, and just, you know, it resonates. You know,
so tell me more about that. I mean, I mentioned earlier, you know, you've been doing more consulting work, you know, jeffmanto.com. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about where you are. You know, we've all been talking about you for years and all of our journeys about the things that you've been doing. But what's Jeff Manto doing right now?
Well, right now I'm into the consulting and coaching coaches at all levels, at the professional level, whether it be professional soccer, professional football, professional basketball. I'm trying and getting into the point of, listen, I don't know the skill set on what you need to do, but I can help you observe people, you know, and through the eyes of my history of where I've been, what I've done good, what I've done bad, my struggles, I could probably help you with a story, tell you a story about something that happened to me along the way, and it might resonate with you. Now, for instance, let's just say one of the coaches is having a problem with a number two guard or a cornerback or a mid guy. You know, do you have a story that, well, I had this one guy, right? He would not listen to me. Okay, what I did is I pulled a Dalai Lama trick on him. I made sure that all his buddies were hitting with me, and he wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, well, I want to try that.
Yeah.
Now, it may not be in a soccer sense, a football sense, a basketball sense, but it's a coaching sense.
Right.
And we as coaches are always coaching the same people, maybe not the same sport. Like, I can't tell you how to kick a soccer ball. I can't tell you how to throw a football. I can't tell you how to shoot, you know, three. But I can sure teach you how to handle a player and handle, you know, a person, most importantly, because these players today, they want to be treated good, as we all do. And so that's what I'm trying to do now and getting into that to where you know, helping coaches coach.
Yeah.
Through different eyes. Like we had said, you said it, you know, unfiltered lens.
Yeah.
You know, like what I'm coming here to tell you as a NFL guy, NBA guy, soccer, MLS guy, I don't know.
That's invaluable, though, the whole unfiltered part. Hunter's done actually has some passion in research as it relates to working with coaches and the consultation end.
Well, as you're talking to a lot of people who try to consult, they look to say, okay, this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. But you're talking, and I think it's a very great point to say, I'm not going to tell you how to do your job.
Right.
You know how to do your job in terms of the techniques, right? The technical skills, right? Now, how to kick a soccer ball, if you will. But you're talking about the process that they go about and how they approach it, how they work with their athletes, how they connect with their players in a different and unique way. And I think that's a really good model for consultation versus saying, hey, this is how you're going to kick, but you don't know how to do that. And that makes you much more genuine because it's, no, this is what I know, and I'm going to impart that on you. I'm going to teach you that. And I think there's a really good model for you.
Thank you. What happened, from my experience, is when you had like former baseball players or up and coming coaches or somebody in the baseball world come and help you coach. The first thing you do as a coach, like, you get on your heels. Like, this guy's, I'm not going to give this guy the information because he wants my job. I know he wants my job because this is his specialty. Where you walk into an environment like, hey man, I don't know anything about throwing football. I know nothing about kicking a soccer ball. I know nothing about, you know, how to run a business, but I know how to deal with people.
Yeah,
you know, when I do
it, it diffuses them. It allows them to kind of settle.
Yeah, I don't want to travel anymore. I've done that. You know, it's right. like when I talk about I love being coached. I think a lot of good players like to be coached.
The best like to be coached.
I love being coached. Okay, and I only got to the big leagues because I was coached. And as I'm looking to do like motivational speaking with companies and getting coached in that, like asking different questions, everybody says, just tell your story. Just tell the story. Like, you know nothing about IBM.
Right.
Why would you go tell the people in IBM how to make a computer? You know nothing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why would I come in here and say, hey, this way you'd be a psychologist?
Right.
I know nothing about it. And that's where I think, where if you just tell the story, somebody's going to say, ah, man, I like that story. Maybe I can use it this way.
Yeah.
I get this, I'm on this email list where we get, it's called Wooden Wednesdays.
Wooden?
Wooden. John Wooden Wednesday.
Oh, okay, Wooden.
Okay.
And wooden. I'm thinking wooden bat.
Yeah. And then they have, they come through with a lot of the John Woodenisms.
Yeah. And there's a lot of them.
Yeah. And what happens, you know what? I can do this if I did this with the baseball team.
Right. Of course you can do it. Mm-hmm. It's all the same language. It's right. just mm-hmm. a different classroom.
Right. And then the thing is, okay, we talked about this before. Lots of times where my mother or my can tell me how to make bake a cake. Mm-hmm. The best cake in the world. Every time I ate my mother's cake, it was the best in the world. She can hand me the recipe. It's going to come out different.
Mm. Right.
So I can give you all the, you can give me all this information. I can give you all the baseball information. And here, go deliver it.
Right. Go bake the cake.
I don't know. It's going to come out different.
Right.
So there's an authenticity as well.
Yes.
That has to play. So there's a lot of guys out there like, I got the information. And they're going to town hall, ringing the bell, hear ye. And you go, who's this guy? Mm-hmm. What are you talking about?
We like to say it for a lot of the mental skills aspects. You can teach a lot of people mental skills, and you were taught it, but you were able to implement it. And mm-hmm. so that's a difference, right? So we like to say mental skills is the knowledge, and mm-hmm. anyone can get that knowledge, that information. But mental strength is the ability to then apply it, right? Mental endurance is to apply it late in a game, right? Mm-hmm. Mental flexibility when things change, and then to recover mentally as well.
The mental strength required to be a professional athlete.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, that unfiltered lens that you can look through, not being affiliated with that sport or with that organization, but through 3+ decades of you being able to say, that's exactly what's required from the between the ears mm-hmm. to sustain right. professional performance.
Yeah, and just like what you guys do, like I can, you know, take what you do, but I can't explain it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I can like I can come in, you know, for a consult with you, and, but I can't go do this on my own.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's an authenticity that you have. There's a believability that you have. There's like it's just the authenticity. That's mm-hmm. the only one right. I can think about.
Right.
You know, and that's what's happening in today's game. It's not. That they're taking authenticity out of it. There's no grind. Hell, you slide in the big leagues, you don't get dirty anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, they don't even have dirt. And now they have these little pebbles. You get up, and that's a nice slide. He gets up, he's clean. Yeah. You know, there's no grind. There's no dirt, you know. But right. So it's the authenticity. I think the people want the authentic deliverer.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
From your career, your tenure in your career, I have a question. What you're talking about, that grind, that grittiness, is there a player you think of particularly, other than yourself, obviously, mm-hmm. that really embodied that style of playing baseball that you can think of, that like you almost looked up to, player or coach?
Oh, I tell you what, I think there's two guys that stand out. One is, and it's I really do hate to say this because nobody saw these two guys when they were young. Jim Thome and Ryan Howard.
Mm-hmm.
You look at them in the Hall of Famers. They must have been great. They weren't. They were not great.
Yeah.
They developed to be great.
Yeah.
And they had one guy in common, Charlie Manuel.
Hmm.
Interesting.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I remember sitting at a beach down in Treasure Island with Jim Thome. We were both in the instructional league. Okay. And he was just a big old country boy. Okay. I don't even know what round he was drafted in. He was a big old country boy and just had some incredible skills. He had eye-hand coordination, and he was strong, similar to Ryan Howard. They're very similar players. Like, they had, respectfully, they had very minimal defensive skills. They couldn't run. They could throw okay. That was it. But they had incredible grit. When you told them something, they listened. And no, Thome was a teammate, you know, so I saw him go through the grind. And he developed himself into a Hall of Famer. Like Ken Griffey, he walked on the field. You knew he's a Hall of Famer. You know, yeah. One of those types of guys. But Jim Thome, he thought he'd have a good career, but nothing like this.
Right.
And Ryan Howard, I'll never forget, I had a chance to coach and manage him. And then it was 2002 in Kannapolis, North Carolina, the opening day in Kannapolis, North Carolina. I'm coaching third base. And in spring training, we were discussing, what are we going to do with Ryan Howard? And they said, you know what? We don't know what we have here. why don't we just send him with Jeff to Lakewood and see what happens with him? Because I was a hitting guy and the manager. Just send him to Lakewood, see what we can do with him. I'm fine with the big boys. First night, first pitch, this guy, their best pitcher, he tries to sneak a 95-mile-an-hour fastball by Howard. Hmm. Now, if you can just paint this picture, just the left center field scoreboard. So left center is far...
far, far away.
Yeah, mm-hmm. far, far away. Okay, no matter yeah. what ballpark you're talking about.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay? He hit this ball, and I actually flinched because it came off like a shotgun. And he hit this thing, and it kept going and going.
It
and
made
going.
Me flinch when you said that.
Yeah. And it was like, I don't believe this ball. And he came around third base. He had a smile this big. And I'm thinking, whoa. And I called him in the office that night. I said, hey, man, what was that? He goes, I don't know. That was pretty cool, wasn't it? I said, yeah, that was pretty cool. I like that stuff. And he goes, what do I do? I said, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to keep you out the left center. And if you remember this, he stayed with it.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. You're going to hit your fastballs out the left center, and you're going to pull your breaking balls.
Yeah. Mm.
And he goes, and then I said, I'll teach you. I didn't know. I thought I was going to be with the Phillies a long time. Then I'll teach you, or somebody's going to teach you how to hit an inside fastball. Then once you learn how to hit an inside fastball, dude, you're good. He goes, teach me now. That's the mentality he had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to know now.
I want to know now.
After a game.
Right.
You know, so it's like... You know, and at that moment, you know, in coaching, believe it or not, the best time to coach a player is when he's doing good.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Sure. So yeah, we often talk about that when we work with our athletes because sometimes they come in and they want something to correct.
Yeah.
And they've got that mentality. As you said, you know, a lot of athletes, some would suggest most, are negative because mm-hmm. they're thinking about what they can't do
right.
or what they haven't done.
Right.
But at the end of the day, they're still making that connection of how they want to improve themselves. So we can highlight and focus on that positive, mm-hmm. then it allows them to really kind of get that next level, that next step.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, man. It's a beautiful thing. But so that those are the guys who, you know, we're talking about the tip of the iceberg mm-hmm. analogy. That those guys were not Hall of Famers when you first saw them. They developed and that grind, that grit, that, you know, and it's a beautiful thing to see when you see the development of a player, even in a little bit when you see him in the cages and mm-hmm. how he starts getting better and better and better. It's a beautiful thing. It really is.
Right. And it's, I want to be that, but it's, you don't see that work. Right? You don't hear those stories. You don't see that development of those people.
Nobody's
or those
paying
players.
Attention.
No.
And I think that's the art that's missed, right? The mm-hmm. work that is put in to develop that. And
yeah.
In order to achieve that, right? In order to obtain that mountaintop, if you will.
Yeah. I think, like, as you guys do here, I think with the BioQ, you know, we can go. I mean, I've said it, and I think I'm not the only one that said it, that we get players, they lift from shoulders down.
Mm.
They get stronger from their shoulders down, and they don't do anything for their minds. And that's probably the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I believe I can do it, I'm going to do it. I can will myself to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And a lot of players don't know that they think if I lift, I run, I throw, I want to get better. Yeah, maybe halfway better.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to have the skills, the BioQ. And what you do here and what I appreciate here is teaching me how to hit under stress.
Mm-hmm.
I never hit without stress.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like for me, the virtual reality thing.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I think it's cool. Don't get me wrong. I think everything's cool.
Right.
Okay. But the boogeyman is not real.
Right.
Mm.
When I shut my eyes, I see all of 6'10 of Randy Johnson.
Mm.
Yeah.
When I'm on that virtual thing, I know it's a game.
Yeah.
I know this is make-believe.
Mm-hmm.
But when I close my eyes, it's like Monsters, Inc., man. When that bullpen door opens, like, oh, man, I hope it doesn't come out of there. So now you're doing is you're hitting on stress.
Here comes Sully.
Right? Yeah, here comes Sully, man. I don't want Sully. Don't close the door.
You don't want Sully, man.
And right. So that's what I'm saying. That's what the BioQ is so cool. It's like, I can hit if there's nothing on the line. I played softball in Trenton. I was good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had 6 homers. But now all of a sudden the game got big. Like, oh, man, I started squeezing the bat. Like, what are you doing, man? It's softball.
Right.
But so, you know, you hit differently. And a lot of guys can, you know, that's what I like about the BioQ. It's like you practice stress.
Yeah. The mm-hmm. technology that we're striving towards, Jeff, and you and I talk about this all the time, is to really – we first introduced this at Sabre, which led us to Brian Kenny in the MLB Network. And actually, full circle, was Jim Tomei,
right.
Who was one of our guests on the show of course, spoke very highly of you. You know, referred to you as Mick.
Yeah. Huh?
And I know that's your that's your major league name. I'm sure there's a lot of stories behind that.
Yeah.
But the technology that we introduced on that show that actually Hunter was wearing was the ability to look at someone's focus from a device that we have inside the helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really next level for us. The technology does exist to be able to determine through BioQ an athlete's focus, their ability to manage stress, all in real time while they're in the cage, and hopefully someday to be the first live evaluation during a game.
That's awesome stuff. It really is because, again, you know, you walk in there and it's, why do some players do better in other environments? You know, I mean, you talk about Derek Jeter and those guys we mentioned at Posada. Like, can you imagine playing in New York every night and doing that well?
Right.
Talk about focus. Where were they?
Mm-hmm. Right.
My God. I mean, 3,000 hits in New York. How do you do that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The championships. How do you do that in New York? You know, so they, I mean, talk about being able to, you know, that's what's going to help a lot of players. It's going to help a lot of mediocre players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's why that took us out of the big leagues, is the ability to breathe, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just catches up to you, the nervousness, and all of a sudden, you know, get out.
Mm-hmm. All right, so plug whatever you want right now. What, jeffmanto.com?
I'm consulting. jeffmanto.com is where you can get a hold of me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Manto Player Development Center.
Jeff Manto on Facebook?
Yeah, Manto Player Development Center.
Okay.
On Facebook. We have different tips of the week type things coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do is I'm working at different locations. I'm working at the NAC here. I'm working at the All-Star. I'm working at Nation 9 in Marsville. And I just found out now that there's a good opportunity for myself to be working at Center Court in Lawrence.
Nice.
Great.
So just trying to get around and spread the simplicity.
Fantastic. Spread the simplicity.
I like that.
So tough.
I like that. Maybe I have to get up there on the website.
I'll tell you. It's funny. I work in the cages and hear these people, these coaching today. I'm like, oh, my God. What these parents are paying for. It's a shame.
Well, I think what they're paying for in so many ways, though, which I can speak to firsthand, is your genuineness.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you take the concept of a very, very difficult task, round ball, round bat, high speed, and you do simplify it to a degree, but it's that authenticity, Jeff, behind it that I think really makes you, you know, one of a kind in the craft that you're, that you're doing. So thank you so much. Appreciate you taking your
Anytime.
Time. Mm-hmm. We said we were going to go for about 90 minutes. We were at 92, brother,
wow.
just for the record.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, you didn't know there was a clock behind you, did you?
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it joining us on the Head Game. It is guests like you that hopefully take this podcast to the next level. So I appreciate the time, brother.
Thank you.
Thanks. That was
fun. All right, man. Great. Thanks so much, everyone. Another edition of the Head Game Podcast. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarello.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.